Okay. Okay, thanks, Prem. So as Prem said, I'm going to be discussing my summer research project here at Perimeter with Param on the probability of slow roll inflation. Okay, so just a few things about slow roll inflation to start. Inflationary cosmology is very successfully resolves the problems of standard cosmology, the fine-tuning problems of flatness and horizon problems. And inflation also generates density perturbations in the early universe that could correspond to the large-scale structure in our observed in our universe today. But slow roll inflationary paradigm does not resolve the singularity problem of standard cosmology. And also, slow roll inflation may suffer from a measure problem. And so like standard cosmology, may also require fine-tuning of initial conditions. And this here is just the energy density diverging as one looks back in time from the slow roll conditions. So indeed, it does have a singularity also. Okay, so the problem or the question is, what is the probability that slow roll inflation is able to successfully resolve the flatness and horizon problems of standard cosmology? And so in order to do this, inflation would have to cause about 60 to 70, or a minimum of 60 to 70 E-folds. Based on observational constraints. And so to answer this question, it will be assumed first that inflation is caused by a scalar field. It's minimally coupled. Secondly, that the field dynamics is governed by the general theory of relativity, and also that our universe is a Friedman, Robertson, Walker universe. Okay, so there's been publication about attractor behavior, so that might be a point that why I even bother with this question, because as the argument goes, for basically any initial conditions that you start with in phi dot space, the solution will go to the inflationary trajectory, which is these bolded trajectories here. And so if basically all solutions go to inflation, then inflation is highly probable. But as I said, we're going to assume that the field dynamics is governed by the general theory of relativity, and that is a Hamiltonian system. So it would be perhaps more informative to consider the phase space, so not phi and phi dot, but phi and p phi.
So what is your Hamiltonian like?
It's going to go on the next slide.
And where does the inflation occur?
Inflation is on these trajectories here, these bolded blue trajectories.
The horizontal ones.
Yes. And I should say that phi is the scalar field. So phi is the scalar field, and phi dot is the change in position with time in the scalar field. Okay, so this is the Hamiltonian that I was talking about of inflation. So there's the potential of the inflaton, which is the scalar field that's causing inflation, its canonical conjugate, and then the scale factor A, and its canonical conjugate. And so looking at this in the phi p phi phase space, then indeed, in fact, the solution doesn't attract to the origin anymore because the scale factor is increasing. So this the amplitude of the oscillation is increasing. So in the canonical phase space, the system is not an attractor. So then we're going to investigate this question of the probability of slow roll inflation.
Where did that Hamiltonian come from?
This Hamiltonian comes from the so if you start with the Lagrangian, it's called S. The scalar action from the Lagrangian. So if you start with like I said, we're doing a Friedman Robertson Walker universe. So that we have the Robertson Walker metric. And that's our scalar action. Yeah, and then the Hamiltonian comes from there.
So there are also gravity terms here, right? Like you should explain with just the gravity part.
And okay, yep. So this is the curvature term here. So that k is minus 1, 0, or plus 1 for open, flat, and closed universes. And then this is also the gravity term here. Well, that's the canonical conjugate of the scale factor term. Okay, so before we keep going, I just want to say a few things about probability and probabilistic arguments. So the first is that all classical probabilities depend on some conditional knowledge. So there's always a conditional knowledge that probability is based on. And the second is that Classical probabilistic arguments can be used only when one completely understands the underlying dynamics and the source of its randomness. So a good example, perhaps, is flipping a coin. So if you just take a coin toss, you know that the coin can be flipped to either side, and gravity is not going to favor a side. So you can reliably predict that it's going to be 50-50 for either side. But say if you did know what force the coin was flipped and where the fulcrum was and where it was going to land and so on, then you could reliably calculate which side, and which side was up at the start, you could reliably calculate which side it will land. So this is an example where now the source of its randomness is different, and so you can't just say it's 50-50. Or another example would be if the coin was a magnet, so it had a north and south pole on each side, and you flipped it in the magnetic field. Well, now it's going to favor a certain alignment depending on the magnetic field, and so your underlying dynamics is different. So you need to have all of these, be aware of all of these when you're making probabilistic arguments. Okay, so just another thing about probability. So let's consider a ridiculous question that was posed by Hollins and Wald. So what is the conditional probability that if cows were to be discovered on a distant planet that their color would be green? So to make a first-order approximation, a physicist might start by, say, looking at the bandwidth in the visible spectrum of the colors that are green and compare that to the total bandwidth of the visible spectrum and come up with a probability. A chemist might, for example, calculate or count the number of chemical compounds that have a green color and divide that by the total number of chemical compounds. A biologist might first estimate the color of the planet by methods similar to the chemist or the physicist, and then take other factors like survival into estimating the probability that the cows are green. So the point is that each of these scientists, have proposed it's a reasonable or kind of a natural way to look at the probability, but all three methods can come up with very different results. So so when we're talking about probability, it's very important to consider how we're going to define the probability. And so this is a concept called a measure. So in the physicist's case, the measure was the bandwidth of the spectrums. And in the chemist's case, it was, say, the number of compounds. So we need to be very careful when we're talking about the probability of inflation of how we define a measure. And so about 20 years ago, Gibbons, Hawking, and Stewart proposed a certain criteria that a natural measure or a sensible measure should satisfy in cosmology. So the first condition is that it should be positive. So that makes sense for probabilities. The second is that it should depend only on the intrinsic dynamics and not on the choice of time slicing or on dependent variables. So if we calculate that probability today or well into the past or well into the future, the probability we calculate should not change. So it shouldn't depend on our time slicing. And then again, we're free to choose whatever dependent variables we wish, and our probability shouldn't change just on our definition. Okay, and then thirdly, the measure should respect all the symmetries of the space of solutions and not introduce any additional ad hoc structures which don't come from the theory. So a good example is sometimes a Planck density cutoff is introduced, and it's just assumed that, say, the universe can't have densities higher than the Planck density. But this doesn't come at all from the theory. So this would be an example of an ad hoc structure that's just been introduced. Okay, so Gibbons, Hawking, and Stewart also went on to show that the canonical Liouville measure of classical mechanics does satisfy these three conditions, where the Liouville measure is just basically the integral of d phi, d pi, d a, d p a. Excuse me. So it's basically you're taking all the coordinates and integrating over each one. And that's your canonical Liouville measure in classical mechanics. And this measure does satisfy those three conditions. So then now, also, Gibbons, Hawking, and Stewart assumed a flat probability distribution. So as like we said, we shouldn't include any additional structures not from the theory. And the theory doesn't give us any specific initial conditions. It doesn't favor any initial conditions. So we want to assume Laplace's principle of indifference, or that is that all the initial conditions are equally likely because we don't have the theory doesn't tell us anything, so we don't want to favor certain initial conditions. Now, That could ultimately be totally wrong in a more correct theory of physics. But since we don't have a very commonly accepted better theory of physics than GER yet, this is a good way to gain an estimate of the probability that we haven't introduced any bias into the initial conditions. And so you might say, well, this isn't a reasonable argument, so like, why even bother? But the point is that if you take that Laplace's principle of indifference and you get a very high or a very low answer, then that tells you something, because like, say if you get a probability that is extremely high, well, now your fundamental theory is going to have to explain, if inflation is going to occur, your fundamental theory is going to, okay. So you get a probability that's extremely high. If you're not going to have inflation in the universe, your fundamental theory is going to have to explain why you're in that regime of very few initial conditions that don't have inflation. So your result is pretty, it's very applicable still if it's extremely high or low. So that's why we're going to use Laplace's principle of indifference. Okay, so Hawking and Page showed that basically if they do assume the Givens Hawking Stewart measure and Laplace's principle of indifference and a Friedman Robertson Mocker model, then in fact the inflationary solutions and the non-inflationary solutions have infinite measure, canonical measure. And so basically they concluded that this leads to an ambiguous probability, because I mean you could define probability as the measure for inflationary solutions over the total measure, but then you have infinity over infinity and that's undefined. Or you could define it as, say, 1 subtract the non-inflationary measure over the total inflationary measure. And again, then you have 1 minus infinity over infinity, which is undefined. So Hawking and Page said basically that this leads to an ambiguous probability. And just to point out, they also mentioned that the infinite measures are due to a divergence in the scale factor, the A coordinate. This is true for all topologies, as far as I understood it. They showed it with a scalar field, and they showed it for specifically the potential, the quadratic potential, 1/2 m squared phi squared. But they argued that basically for any potential, that this could occur.
For k equal to 1 and k equal to minus 1.
If in k equals minus 1 and k equals 1, you can have a going infinite still, because the divergence is from this a coordinate. So in those cases, if a can diverge, then you can have divergence in the measure. Okay, so this puts basically another condition on the measure. So I like the way Hollins and Wald explain it. If you consider the case where there exists a manifold M, so this is our canonical phase space, representing the possible states of the system on which there's defined a measure mu, so we're taking the canonical measure, such that mu of M equals infinity, which is the case in the Givens Hawking Stewart measure. And then if there's a property Q, so inflation of the system, that corresponds to a measurable subset S, which will be our inflationary trajectories through the phase space of M, then there's exactly 3 possibilities for your probability. So the first is that if your mu s, so that's your measure on the inflationary solutions, is less than infinity, and then therefore your measure on the non-inflationary solutions is infinite. So you can define your probability as the ratio of the inflation to the total, and you'll get 0. If it's the reverse, and the measure on the non-inflationary solutions is less than infinity, but the measure on the inflationary solutions is infinite, then you can define your probability as 1 minus the ratio of the non-inflationary to the total. And in that case, you'll have a probability of 1. But if they're both infinite, which is what happened at Hawking and Page showed, then your probability is undefined. And so a fourth condition on the measure is that if your measure on the total canonical phase space is infinite, then you can't have the inflationary and non-inflationary measures infinite also, in order to have a defined probability. So then, more recently, Givens and Turok showed that the canonical measure can be viewed as a magnetic flux through phase space. So basically, you have your initial conditions, which correspond to trajectories through the phase space, and then your measure is the flux of these trajectories. So Givens and Turok also demonstrated that the Givens-Hawking-Stewart measure diverges because of the scale factor, as was pointed out in the last slide. And then they argued that in the limit of extremely large scale factor, the value of the scale factor is neither geometrically meaningful or physically observable. So in the sense that if you have a flat universe or a closed universe, so these are curved universes, but an open or closed universes. These are closed universe. These are, if you have an open or closed universe, these are curved universes. But if your scale factor is extremely large, then the curvature becomes extremely small, your radius of curvature. And so these universes are effectively flat in the limit that your scale factor diverges. So you can basically say that this goes beyond observational limit. Like at some point, our observations in classical arguments will be limited to some limit. So at some point, we're not going to be able to determine between these universes. And then also, the scale factor is not meaningful in a flat universe. It's only the change in scale factor with time, or the difference in scale factor at two different times, that has meaning in a flat universe. So basically, they said that in this limit, A is not meaningful. So the way they deal with this is by introducing a cutoff on A. And basically, they propose to distinguish between those scale factors, those universes which are distinguishable, and those that are not. And this ultimately results in a cutoff on A. And so then using Stokes' theorem, they can evaluate this flux as the line integral of the canonical coordinate d phi, which is equal to twice the integral of the A cubed phi dot d phi. Because in this case, this p phi is equal to A cubed phi dot. That comes from the... Okay, so Gibbons and Turok further showed that if you evaluate their measure in the when the Hubble parameter is extremely low, then basically you have adiabatic expansion, and so this measure actually becomes independent of your cutoff, which is desirable because you don't want your measure to depend on this cutoff, which you argued is physically reasonable, but you don't actually have a value for it. So it makes sense then to evaluate the measure in the regime where it's independent of the cutoff. And so basically it becomes independent of the cutoff. The way it becomes is because when you have this adiabatic expansion, it corresponds to oscillating about the minimum and the potential. And so while this is going on, the scale factor basically evolves independently of the phase. So it doesn't depend on phi. It's just as a background function of time. And so it comes out of your measure. So basically, in that limit that's oscillating about the minimum potential, you can define a new Hamiltonian that only depends on the inflaton, the scalar field. And if we take this potential, because at the minimum, the Taylor series, you can approximate basically any potential as this quadratic. And so this line integral just becomes the area of the ellipse in the phi p phi space. And in that case, it's equal to 2 pi times the Hamiltonian over M, where the Hamiltonian is the energy of the system. So, and indeed, this is independent of the cutoff. There's no value for the scale factor there. So as I said, since the Gibbons and Turok measure loses its cutoff dependence in this regime of adiabatic expansion, then that's where we want to evaluate the measure. So the measure is actually evaluated. Rather than evaluating it while it's oscillating here, what it's done is it's evaluated right before it enters that oscillatory phase, so where it's still adiabatic expansion, but right before. So the slow roll inflation, the scalar field has rolled down from higher up on the potential, and then it's evaluated right at the end of slow roll inflation before the oscillation starts. Okay, so just to make that clear, the approach is to calculate the measure at the end of slow roll inflation for those solutions which experience n or more e-folds of inflation, and then also for all solutions, and then the ratio of the two measures can be interpreted as the probability for inflation. Okay, so just to throw some equation at you, if we assume a flat universe, then this is our Friedman equation here, and this is the scalar field equation. And so using these two equations, one can derive a value for the change. Thank you, Param. Change in the Hubble parameter with time, and so you can get expression here for phi dot. This can go back into your Friedman equation, and this is a will be a more operationally useful definition of the Friedmann equation. And also using this phi dot, the canonical measure, the Gibbons and Turok measure can be written like so, which will be the operational definition for that measure. So then in the regime of low Hubble parameter and adiabatic expansion, we said that the scale factor is going to evolve independently of time. So in this regime specifically, the scale factor can come out of the integral because it doesn't depend on phi. So it will cancel from our numerator and our denominator. So our probability for n or more e-folds of inflation will be the measure evaluated for all solutions which have n or more e-folds of inflation divided by the total measure. It basically corresponds to right before this scalar field starts oscillating both the minimum and the potential. And then also I'm going to present the slow roll solution and an argument for the end there also. So to first order the slow roll solution, the Friedmann equation is given by this here, just solved iteratively. And so another answer to when is the end of slow roll inflation would be when your deviation from the Hubble parameter is say of the same magnitude as your first order correction term. Okay, so now if we take this slow roll solution and perturb it, so basically we reintroduce some deviation, then we could say that the Hubble parameter is given by the slow roll plus the deviation in H, and the potential is similarly defined. Now, in slow roll inflation, the derivatives of V are small. So we can set delta V equal to 0 here. And then one can show that you can derive this expression. So that is the change in the deviation with n grows as 3 times the deviation, which integrates here. So the point is that your deviation from the slow roll solution. Okay, so sorry, I should say that this expression assumes that we're looking backwards in time with n. So we've started at the end of slow roll inflation where we said we're calculating, and then no more e-folds of inflation are going to occur, so we're looking backwards in time. So what this says is that if we have some deviation from the slow roll solution on our measure surface, then the total deviation is going to grow as the exponential of 3n as we look backwards in time. So in other words, the solutions are going to move away from the slow roll solution. And then you can also show using this system that the deviation in H in the slow roll solution will go approximately as m. M is the mass of the inflaton, the scalar field, over the root of n. And so we'll say that slow roll inflation ends when this deviation is basically of the same order as this first order correction term. So this is the last page of equations. So here's the probability that we had earlier, and basically now the new, okay. So this is our perturbation in H here. So if we look at dH d phi, then that's dH slow roll d phi. But we said that H slow roll is just a function of our potential, and the derivatives of the potential are small. So that term is basically zero when we take dH d phi, and so our dH d phi evaluated here is just the deviation. So our numerator can be approximated as just the deviation on the measure surface. And then the denominator can be calculated as that we calculate it for, it's going to be calculated for all solutions on that surface. And then that turns out to be of approximately order m. And so the result, the main result, is that your probability for inflation goes as decreases as the exponential of your e-fold. And so observational constraints put n at a minimum of 60 or 70. So this number becomes extremely small in those limits. And the probability for inflation using this measure and Laplace's principle of indifference is very small. Okay, so just a couple other things in the literature. So Kaufman, Linde, and Mikhanov, who had talked about that attractor theorem earlier on, they argue that the decay of the scalar field and the particle production that results are irreversible processes. And so specifically they state that in inflationary cosmology, the total energy and entropy of the scalar field and particles created by its decay is not conserved. Now, okay, so then they say that for these reasons, inflationary dynamics is definitely not measure preserving. But the Gibbons and Turok measure, the only thing that we've considered here was the Hamiltonian, and that is equal to zero from earlier on. And so that's conserved equal to zero the whole time, so that this argument probably won't apply in that case. And so Kaufman, Linde, and Mikhanov say that the probability of inflation should not be evaluated at the end of inflation because of the irreversible processes. So what they propose to do is they define a measure that's just the integral of d phi dot d phi. So this is very similar to the Gibbons and Turok measure, except the A cubed scale factor is not there. And so then what they do is evaluate this measure at the Planck density. But this is kind of the ad hoc structure that Gibbons, Hawking, and Stewart were talking about, because there's not any particular reason to assume that the initial conditions were imposed at the Planck density of the universe as opposed to any other density. And so when they evaluated this measure, they assumed Laplace's principle of indifference, but the initial conditions are constrained such that the total energy density is the Planck density. And with this measure, you can find that the probability of slow roll inflation is 1 minus order m at the Planck density. So Kaufman, Linde, and Mikhanov quoted this for just inflation to occur. But like I said, we want to see that there's at least 60 or 70 e-folds of inflation. So we checked that occurs, and it's actually true even for 60 or 70. It's still approximately 1 minus order m. So for example, if m is about a millionth the Planck mass, which is within the observational constraint, current observational constraint, then the probability goes as basically 1 still at the Planck density. But the point is that this measure defined by Kaufman, Linde, and Mikhanov is not surface independent. So the Planck density was an ad hoc structure that didn't fit really the Gibbons, Hawking, Stewart conditions. And this measure also highly depends on time slicing, which was the second of the conditions. So it depends very sensitively on where you evaluate it. And if, say, for example, you evaluate it, or they say if you evaluate it at the end of slow roll inflation, your probability will just be of order m. Now it's about 1 over a million. And so that obviously if you go from 1 to 1 over a million, it depends sensitively on where you evaluate it. And this is true not just for inflation, but also for 60 or 70 e-folds of inflation. So just one other... Yep.
Was that even if you compute their, if you take their measure and you compute the probability at the end of inflation, you will still get around 1.
Theirs was that you will get of order m here at the end of inflation. So for example, when they're using order m is about 1 over a million, so you get about probably inflation is 1 over a million, which is a lot higher than the Gibbons and Turok measure would be. But
that must be the probability of any.
Yes.
For
this is for inflation to occur.
Exactly. So it's consistent with ours, but it's irrelevant because what you're interested to know is, was there at least 60 e-folds?
Right. Okay.
I think if you worked out their measure at the end of inflation, you get the same results. E minus
3n.
3 times 60.
Right.
So if they don't do that, they in somehow a semantic way of saying, kind of, we're not that bad anyway. But then sliding, I mean, we're not interested in the question.
Right.
Just get one e-fold of inflation. It's not interesting.
Well, exactly, it doesn't resolve the problem.
So you computed at the end of inflation. Only at the end of inflation, you computed with their measure.
Yes. So, well, see, the way I computed was just if you take some other different density surface and look forward, what is the probability that you're going to have any folds of inflation? But my computation isn't as robust or useful because there could have been e-folds of inflation that occurred before. So it still suffers from the same problem that it depends on your surface. Whereas the Gibbons and Turok...
If I want to compute the probability for 60 foldings and the probability decreases as we go towards that computation.
Yes.
I think Neil's point is perhaps completely right, that if we will compute that probability at phi equal to 1 where the inflation ends, maybe we'll get exponentially suppressed.
Probably, yeah. That would make sense. And so the nice thing about the Gibbs and Turok is that by looking backwards in time, they're considering basically as long as you have some point in the universe where you're at the end of slow roll inflation, you can consider any densities that were greater than that, and you can calculate the probability for n or more equals of inflation. So it's a better way of defining the measure at the end of slow roll inflation. So there's also a paper by Carroll and Pam, in which they argue that the Gibbs and Turok approach of distinguishing between the scale factor, they say this is basically removing almost all of the solutions and keeping a set of measure zero. And so what they propose to do instead is a new regularization scheme that ultimately results in the measure. And this is the measure they give in their paper. But this is effectively the Kaufman-Mendez-McConnell measure, because this here from the Friedman equation is just phi dot. So you have the integral of phi dot d phi, which is the same as the integral of d phi dot d phi, twice the integral, the double integral of d phi dot d phi. And so it suffers from the same problem that it's also surface dependent. And then Carroll and Tam evaluate their measure at the Planck density, which again is a bit of an ad hoc structure, and they let the mass of the inflaton be about 3/1000ths of the Planck mass. And so they used, they used computer simulations to determine for what initial conditions will 60 or more e-folds of inflation occur. And they found that as long as phi is not in the region from minus 24 to 6, but when you're at Planck density, then you'll have more than 60 e-folds of inflation. And they quoted this number here for their normalized measure. Now they did not say this was their probability for inflation, because they went on to consider different motives for probability, but they said this was a normalized measure. And this was surprising to Perriman and I, because it's not 1 minus order m for the m that they've taken. So we did a look into this, and basically we calculated, we applied their technique and calculated this was the probability, which is of order m, and so that's as expected. And then also, just to point out, I checked this, if this was 3/1,000,000, so e to the minus 6 of the Planck mass, and then actually this is the result I get, so it may have just been a typo in their paper. Okay, so to conclude, we start out with the question of what is the probability that slow roll inflation will resolve the problems of standard cosmology, the flatness and horizon problems. And so using the Gibbons and Turok measure and assuming Laplace's principle of indifference, one can calculate that the probability for n or more equals inflation goes exponentially. It goes down exponentially. So the probability in this case is very small. But like I said, Laplace's principle of indifference, it doesn't necessarily rule out inflation 100%. It means that if the inflation is to occur by a scalar field, then there would have to be a fundamental theory that specifically constrains that the initial conditions would be those few initial conditions that do correspond to inflation. And so basically, to quote the way Gibbs and Turok finish off, is that the question of how or why inflation occurred in our universe remains a deep mystery and a challenge for the fundamental theory.
Do you have any thoughts yourself on how to resolve this divergent measure?
Yeah. I mean, I thought a lot about it, but I'm still figuring all out. I think it's like your paper just I think it resolves the issue. I think what would put a final stamp on it is to come up with so the way you came up with a clever technique to remove this divergence. But then the slow roll inflation is evaluated at the end. I think what would put a final stamp is if someone could come up with a clever technique to do this earlier on in the universe, and then evaluate the probability then, and then any entropy arguments or time reversal invariance arguments don't apply also. But my thoughts are that based on this the theory of general relativity, that slow roll inflation, we may also need to consider other mechanisms for inflation to occur.
But the
With respect to the time reversal question,
right?
I mean, the microscopic, even though it's true that the scalar field is not the whole story, there's all kinds of other particles and stuff. The entire system is a Hamiltonian system. And,
right.
Adding more degrees of freedom is not necessarily going to explain or make it any easier to explain initial conditions. So, in fact, if you take more than one scalar field, take m scalar fields,
okay.
The probability for inflation is e to the minus 3 m times m.
Oh, okay.
It gets worse. So adding more degrees of freedom is not, I believe, not going to help you. Because say you put in gravitational waves, I mean, they exist as inhomogeneous modes, they're additional modes of the system. They do behave like scalar fields, essentially. And I think it would be the same. It just makes the problem worse. So, you know, Roger Penrose had an argument which I guess we refer to, but which our calculation doesn't really connect with successfully. But his argument is that the entropy of the Sitter space is supposed to be the area of the horizon volume. And if you work out the entropy associated with inflation at the beginning, it is a very, very tiny fraction of the entropy associated with the state of inflation near the end. And so it's saying that the initial conditions for inflation are in fact extremely unlikely by an even bigger factor than ours. So ours is just a classical argument, but his argument is supposed to be based on quantum theory of black holes and entropy of black holes in the Sitter space. But, you know, he has this diagram with God and the pin pointing at the place in phase space, and that's the place where inflation has to start. So I think there's some, you know, there's still some work to be done to get rid of the divergence in the measure, to connect with the quantum theory, and so on. But personally, I think that adding more degrees of freedom just actually will make the problem worse. If you believe in the formula for entropy of black holes into Sitter space, they're supposed to include all the degrees of freedom.
Right.
And when you do that, the probability gets much smaller than this. So mini superspace is probably generous to inflation. After all, in mini superspace, you're assuming the universe is homogeneous.
Right. Right.
Which certainly helps with inflation. You put it in homogeneity. Those only hurt. They never help inflation. So I think this is a generous approach. But still, you know, it's a very unpopular point of view.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, inflation definitely, it nicely resolves the problems of standard cosmology and the density perturbations.
Yeah.
So a lot of people want to run with it.
Yeah.
But that may be why it's unpopular.
Yeah, that is exactly why it's unpopular.
Right.
So the Hollands and Roll measure.
Yes.
Was it? Do they have the same measure? Which
Hollands and Walls actually they didn't give a measure,
okay.
But they were talking. They basically gave an argument about how to develop a measure like the Gibbs and Turok measure, in which they said that instead of just assuming a Planck or any density and going and calculating the measure and going from there, they said basically that you can use the time reversal invariance because of GR, and so you can start way down somewhere else and then look at the probability of inflation as you go backwards. So their measure was similar, but they didn't have a measure, but they gave an argument very similar.
They didn't do any calculations.
Yeah, exactly.
But they did support using the measure.
Right.
And advocate.
Exactly.
Any other questions? Okay, so let us thank Jason.